Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey friends, welcome to the Tennis and Bagels podcast. This is Vanch here, and today we have a special episode. It's a tradition. As always, after every major, we bring on Steve Flink, the writer, a great writer and a wonderful historian and member of the Tennis Hall of Fame, International Tennis Hall of Fame, and he's written two books, Pete Sampras' Greatness Revisited and The Greatest Tennis Matches of All Time. And so this is my conversation with Steve. Hello, Steve. Great fortnight wrapping up Wimbledon. You were there for the last 8 days. How was your experience overall?
Oh, it was terrific. It was great to be back because I hadn't been back since 2019, the epic Djokovic-Federer final. And then obviously there's no tournament in 2020. And last year I covered from home because there were too many restrictions, justifiable restrictions, by the way, but restrictions that would have made me question whether it was worth being on site last year. That was not the case this year. It was just like times of old, and I enjoyed it immensely.
Terrific. So I guess let's start with the men's final since it's fresh in our mind. Djokovic against a surprise finalist in Nick Kyrgios. How did you kind of see that match? I thought it was a pretty good showing for Nick. I mean, many people were speculating how he would react to his first major final and how would he play against Djokovic, the matchup with the potentially one of the best servers in the game against the greatest returner of all time in Novak. I think it delivered, and Nick actually performed pretty well.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, obviously he had the default from Nadal in the semifinals. So, he hadn't played since Wednesday yet. So he had 3 days off, came back on Sunday. That was a long time for him to be dwelling on this upcoming encounter. And therefore it made his first set performance all the more remarkable. Because you would think that's where the nerves might have shown and he would have just come out there and been out of his match rhythm and out of his serving rhythm and just out of sorts playing in his first major final like this. But that was not the case. And Djokovic just made one bad move that cost him the set. And that was going for a big second serve at 2-all break point down. He'd saved one break point already. Now he went for, I believe, 111-mile-an-hour second serve down the tee and sent it into the net. I didn't think it was worth that gamble for him. Nobody ever asked him about it in the press conference because there were too many other things to talk about. But I felt that he would have been much better off. Nick was not going to crush that return. Just get the second serve in as deep as possible. So that cost Djokovic the first set. Otherwise, he was holding quite easily. Nick was serving magnificently. And then finally at 5-4 in that first set, Novak did get to deuce. He made an impression there in that game, and Nick was a bit nervous, made a few bad plays, a bad serve and volley that backfired, but he got through it and held on with an ace, and that was commendable for Nick to tuck away that first set and be two sets away from his first Wimbledon title. But then, of course, the complexion changed quite dramatically at the start of the second set.
Just to add a little bit of what you were saying in the first set, I was also looking forward to seeing how the baseline exchanges would play out once Djokovic got the return back in play. So I was interested in sort of the cross court backhand to backhand exchanges because Nick obviously he has a short take back on the backhand. It stays very low. It's very flat. It sort of skids through the grass, and so I was curious to see how that would match up. And Nick was actually doing quite a good job of getting it quite low and forcing Djokovic to dig out some uncomfortable backhands, and then actually staying with him in the long rallies as well, which, hasn't always been the case for Nick, but he seemed really focused and dialed in. And obviously it helped the way he was serving, and Djokovic didn't really have a great read on his serve. But that all changed, as we know, in the second set.
Oh, I agree with all of that. I was surprised by his consistency from the backcourt, Nick's consistency, that is, by his patience. I only have a slight disagreement. I feel that with the back, and he has the short backswing, and it can be biting. I didn't think it was terribly biting necessarily, but it did stay. Oh, that's where I totally agree with you. And so Djokovic was dealing with some low, no pace balls. That's not fun for him. He'd rather have some pace coming at him. And then Nick was very disciplined off his forehand in the first set. Really, really, for most of the match, he didn't go for reckless winners. You know, he hit it hard and heavy, but he measured it pretty well. So you're right. The baseline prowess of Kyrgios in the first set was one of the standout features in addition to his blockbuster serving. So those were the two things that earned him the set, and Novak was sort of coming to terms with that and discovering what he was going to have to do in the second set to turn this. And I think really what he did, Bonch, was, I mean, a lot was made about that one all game in the second set. It was very important because he's a 30 all. He doesn't want to go down a break. He wins a 23 stroke rally, but really probing both sides, moving Nick side to side, eventually extracting an error off Nick's backhand. And then the next point was another long rally that Novak ended with a backhand cross-court drop shot winner. And that hold was so big that I think it really boosted Djokovic's morale and carried him right through the next game when he broke at love. Mm. So I feel like those two games changed that match significantly. And then, of course, we got to that last game of the second set. Novak trying to serve it out. He'd had 5-2. Nick had a nice hold in his 5-3. Love 40 on Novak's serve. And I thought he was very poised at that point. He knew how important that game was. He doesn't want to let Nick back on serve and eventually have that set potentially settled in a tiebreak, which could be a roll of the dice at that stage. A lot of pressure on him. And he just took it point by point very nicely. Didn't try to do too much with the first serve, sliced it to Nick's forehand a couple of times. The next thing you know, he's back to deuce. Nick gets a fourth break point, and then Novak hit a terrific. He played that point really well and hit. You didn't think he was going to try it, but he was moving forward into the court, but a little bit into the alley, and he hit a backhand drop down the line that Nick could not handle. And that was a critical hold, I really thought. What did you think about the second set?
Yeah, I thought that was the standout game. You highlighted it perfectly, the one-all game, those two long points, followed by the backhand drop shot cross court for 2-1, and then the break at love. He really did such a good job in that game, reading Nick's serve and getting such deep returns back and making Nick sort of half volley on his forehand, a lot of, just right at his feet. And then at 5-3, I thought he did, he hit his spots perfectly. I mean, he didn't do too much with the serves, but he knows that's the play against Kyrgios, because Kyrgios, if you give him a sort of a kick second serve on the backhand, he can really sort of attack it and take it early. But on his forehand, he doesn't like that return as much. He doesn't like the forehand return and the body. When you serve at his body, he gets kind of jammed. So that was a perfect play. And then the drop shot, his drop shot throughout the match, I thought was just spot on. Like his feel on that shot, the when to go after it. And it was just his court sense throughout the rest of the match was just perfect.
Like, yeah, I thought also a couple of those first serves that back hit in the 5-3 game, when they were in the range of 115. He can go a little bigger than that, but he wisely just wanted to get the spin on it, slice it, force Nick to come up with something on his forehand return, which Nick was unable to do. A couple of errant returns there. That was a very impressive game at a critical juncture of the match for Djokovic. And then I thought he was going to break Nick at the start of the third. He had a couple of break points, almost had him there. The momentum was with him decidedly. But again, that was another example of Nick's competitiveness on the day and his poise for the most part, despite these crazy outbursts in between points with his camp. Once the point began back down on the court, he was inside himself again. That impressed me. I a lot of times that's not the case. If he's talking to his entourage, then it's carrying over into his play. But in this case, you know, that was a very good hold at the start of the third to keep Djokovic from really rolling along on after taking the second set. And then we eventually got to 4-all. But by that time, I thought Djokovic had totally found his range from the baseline, Vonch. No longer was Nick going to be winning the long rallies. That was gone. And Novak was probing left and right. His depth was better. He just was very confident and rhythmic from the baseline. and which is hard to do on that court and hard to do against Nick, but he had that. And here's where one of the few times I've ever disagreed with Novak Djokovic in one of his sort of post-match assessments, but he said in several interviews, Nick gifted me that 4-all game from 40 love. I don't agree, because I look back on those points and I say, okay, so Nick should put away the forehand volley at 40 love, but it's a little bit of an awkward high forehand volley. He had served and volleyed, and that was his second one. And sure, he should have probably put it away, but Novak tracked it and passed him down the line. Nothing that awful on Nick's part there. And then next point, Djokovic hits a very good pass right at Nick's feet that was just unmanageable. And then third one, you know, Djokovic, a deep return down the middle that set up a forehand inside in winner. We had Nick trapped. So I would say that was some pretty good work from Novak to get back to deuce, to rattle Nick, who then double faults and then makes a pretty routine backhand error off a backhand return from Novak that was semi-deep, but not that deep. So I think it was a combination of things. Yes, Nick definitely lost his grip a bit, but Novak played it point by point methodically and well. And I think he did his part to earn the break. The total gift. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I do think he definitely earned it. He did very well to get to deuce. I did kind of think maybe on one of those volleys that it was a tough ask, obviously. But Nick is a good volleyer, and maybe, you know, with his soft hands, he could have maybe snuck one of them out. But I agree with you. Like, the passing shots were terrific. The one at 40-15, I believe, was like right at his feet. So it was tough to expect him to dig that out in that situation. And then the double fault, I think, was definitely probed by the previous point.
Yeah. And that was Djokovic at his best, because he actually didn't hit that inside in forehand that hard, but it was deadly accurate inside the sideline. And Nick was completely frozen near the middle of the court and surprised by the direction of the shot. So anybody's point of view is, it was a clutch break for Novak, obviously. And then he serves it out. And suddenly, just like that, he's 2-1 up. But I felt like he had outplayed Nick in that set. He made it sound like he thought it was like even Steven. I don't think so. I felt like Novak was giving it. It was the break points in the first game. There was another deuce game. He seemed to be on him almost every service game. And then, ironically, he wins the one that it looks like he's going to lose. While you go back to the first game of the set, and it looked like it was going to break. So I felt like it was a set that was that belonged in his column in the end.
Yeah, it's interesting that he undersold himself a little bit there. Maybe it's just sort of, it happened so quickly, like from 40 love to the end of the game. And then obviously with all the chirping from Nick to his box and just how quickly he plays in between points, maybe it sort of felt like from deuce, he won the game so super quick just because of the double fault and then the backhand in the net, which, you know, in that time, I didn't feel like Nick showed any patience. He sort of just...
No, he wouldn't.
No, what he won a winner there, and just
He did. Although he wasn't even hitting it that hard, he was a little. I thought he's a bit confused, you know. He definitely thinking about the score, and instead of just focusing on the point itself. But here's
where I feel like is a noticeable difference between the two players, because I feel like Novak sort of played this match point for point, and he sort of treated every point like it was the same. Whereas Nick, I feel like he was playing the score a lot more.
Yeah, I agree. And there was a sort of a singular intense focus from Novak. I think he made up his mind. He knew when he joked ahead of the match that there were going to be some fireworks. Uh-huh. I think he then went back and said to himself, but they better not be from me, because he realized he was much better off in this. There are times when he bent, when it's worth it to him against certain players at particular times to just let it out. Not when he's playing Nick. He was much better off to let Nick be the one to always be, you know, be the emotional one erupting here and there and quite frequently. And Novak just kept his mind completely focused on winning the match and was exceedingly calm to his benefit, to his definite benefit. But I have to say this, the fourth set to me was very impressive from Nick's end. Because I was sitting with Chuck Culpepper of the Washington Post, and he had speculated with me as the third set was ending. Did we think that perhaps Novak might make a real move in the fourth? You know, that Nick would be a bit disconsolate. But that was not the case. Nick had, you know, perhaps his best, most consistent serving set. You could compare it, probably comparable to the first set, but never even pushed to deuce. Neither player was even pushed to deuce. Novak did a terrific job serving from behind all through that set. And he was 2 points from losing the set at 30 all. They were a bit shaky in the 5-6 game, but he just steadied himself beautifully to get into that tiebreak. And then you had that sense that this was going to be one of those Djokovic tiebreaks where nothing was going to be, and Nick was going to get no presence. Novak was going to make, he made the one unforced error when he was serving a two love that at the time I thought might be costly, but Nick had started the breaker with that double fault on the tee going for a big second serve. And Novak, I thought maybe he'd really distance himself, but that was an opportunity you thought possibly for Nick to get the mini break back, be serving at 1-2. And that stage impressed me a lot because Novak made a couple of very good, one really good first serve return that eventually led to him going up 3-1 on an error from Nick off the forehand. And then a good return off a tough first serve on the 3-1 point. And Nick tried to do too much to angle his backhand cross court and sending it wide. So those 2 points, if someone had told Novak he's going to get two first serves in here, do you think you can get either one? He'd say, I hope so. He got both. And I think then he was in the driver's seat. And I thought he was very, very disciplined, stretching it from 4-1 to 6-1. And then Nick did a nice job to win a couple of points on his serve and make Novak serve it out at 6-3. But that's just what Djokovic did. One of his typical sort of strategic points, moving Nick around, great depth, great control until he finally got the short ball and came in off his forehand and extracted that backhand passing shot error from Nick. So I just thought it was a first-class match. Excuse me, Bunch. I would rate it maybe slightly higher than the Berrettini final a year ago.
Totally agree.
Start to finish, I think it was a better match. And I think that Nick, despite all of his histrionics, gave a good account of himself, very good account. But he also brought out the best in Djokovic. Now, it was interesting, Vansh, listening to some of the BBC comments after the match. And some of the BBC commentators thought that this was far and away Novak's best match. I'm not sure it was. I thought he played incredibly well the last three sets against Sinner. I think the Sinner match was certainly on that level the last three sets. And that he was at a pretty high level most of the tournament, despite dropping six sets in the seven matches.
Yeah.
I felt like, all told, he had a reason to be confident going in there. And you could say that he peaked for the final, but I thought he was at a good high level across the whole fortnight.
Yeah, that was my feeling as well. The last three sets against Sinner for me were just, I mean, he was giving away absolutely nothing. It was like lockdown mode.
But very innovative, very authoritative, very aggressive, and serving extremely well those last three sets.
Oof, yeah.
It like a switch went off, because the strange thing about the Sinner match, Vansh, was that Novak, I thought, should have won the first set. He was 4-1 and had a break point for 5-1. Sinner hit a very good first serve to save it. And then Djokovic played one of his worst games at 4-2. Mm-hmm. Couple of drop shot errors. It just was a disastrous game for him.
Right.
And that was a giveaway game in a way, because he really didn't earn any of those points.
Yep, you're right. Two double faults and two drop shot errors.
Doubles and two drop shots. It was crazy. And then he ends up losing the set 7-5 and losing the second set 6-2. And it reminded me oddly of a totally different, lesser caliber player, another Italian, Musetti, last year, where Novak should have won the first set there. Had ample opportunities, had a big lead in the tiebreak, and he didn't put Musetti away. And the next thing you know, he's been crushed in the second set, and he's got himself in a two-set deficit. And I thought this was strangely reminiscent of that. Mm-hmm. But no, and once in same similarity again, he goes to take the bathroom break after the second set. But I thought the way that he reset at the start of the third, and the kind of tennis that he produced there, those might have been his three best sets of the tournament.
Yeah. In my mind, those were the three best. And definitely the way he was able to flick that switch, like you said, and just, I didn't think Sinner played badly in those last three sets.
No, at all.
So it was
totally agree. That's what made it so remarkable to me, is that Sinner did not play badly, but he couldn't believe what was being thrown at him. He was astounded by the quality, the improved quality of Novak's returns, and then just the groundstroke execution and the way he orchestrated those points the last three sets was really pretty inspiring stuff. And then more surprising to me, Vance, was the semifinal. Bit surprised that he was so nervous in the first set, Djokovic, because he came out and lost his serve against Cam Nori. Okay, fair enough. Tight at the beginning, but you break right back, hold for 2-1. Then he made that great tweener lob in the next game. And you thought, okay, he's relaxed now. But he wasn't, because from that point at 2-1, he didn't win another game that set. That's not like him. And yet, even there, again, similar to Sinner, he didn't play quite as well, but it was still really high-level stuff. Once he turns it in the second set, goes up 5-3 with the break against Nori, you know, then there was just no stopping him. And Nori did very well to keep the fourth set as close as he did to only one break, because Novak had one other break game, could have gone up 4-1 in a second break, had four break points. He played really well that game, but Nori somehow fended him off and stayed in there to the end. But that one was one I had the feeling, Vance, that he just kind of wanted to get it done, get it over with. You know, it was a tricky match to play. It's a British player on the center court. They weren't at that frenzied level of, say, an Andy Murray crowd that he had dealt with back in the 2013 final, but they still were obviously solidly behind Nori. And then toward the end, there were some hecklers in the stands who were kind of getting on Novak's nerves a bit as he tried to serve the match out, but he got through that. And I felt like that was sort of the way he felt that day, was that, you know, he wanted to get it over with and start thinking about the final. He was better against Sinner and Kyrgios than he was against Nori in many ways.
Yeah, totally. I was also a little bit surprised at how aggressive Nori was playing in that match. After he won the first set, I thought he was really going after it and, you know, trying to finish points and wasn't getting the finishes he was looking for. But I was surprised he didn't try and play a little bit more steady from the back of the court and maybe perhaps force Djokovic into some of those longer exchanges, particularly his forehand.
I think he didn't trust himself in the longer rallies. You're right, because you think of Nori, we think of him in most of his matches, and that's how he does it. Mm-hmm. Puts up kind of a brick wall off that back end. You feel like he could steer it cross court all day long, you know, and he measures his forehand and he doesn't miss.
Yeah.
But I think he felt that Novak was too good at that game for him. It made him press.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what happened. You're right. I didn't expect that kind of a game plan, but looking back, I understand why he played that way.
Yeah, totally. And then, you know, I was very impressed. I guess let's talk bigger picture for Novak before we move on to Rafa. But,
sure.
You know, there was a lot of pressure coming into this event for Djokovic, you know, because it's pretty unlikely right now that he'll play the US Open. And we don't know what the situation in Australia is. You know, it's probably somewhat maybe likely that they'll, you know, forego that 3-year ban and maybe we'll see him there. But it's not a given for sure. So.
Yeah, let me just jump in there for a second. I do think I would be really surprised if they didn't let that go. They know how they suffered this year. I don't think they want another confrontation. They proved their point this past year.
I agree.
And so I think the people assuming that he won't be in Australia are wrong. I think the people, like you just said, who are assuming he won't be at the U.S. Open are probably right, because it's hard to see the policy changing so quickly now, since we're already pushing into the middle of July, that they would change it in time for him to come to the U.S. Open in the latter stages of August, but very unlikely. But I think he's been very dignified about that, in the sense of not complaining, but just accepting that that's probably going to be the reality.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, it puts him back in pole position. He's one ahead of Roger now and, you know, just one behind Rafa. And, you know, this was very much a much needed boost for him in terms of the overall race.
Yeah, I think he looked at it. It's well sized up bunch. I think he looked at it as sort of a must win situation, you know, and then once Rafa was out, well, either way, whether he was going to face Rafa or not, he felt like this was his turf. This was his tournament. He's going for his seventh title. He's going for his fourth in a row. And I think he felt that it was one he could not let get away. And you could feel it and hear it in his press conference after the semifinals, as he looked ahead to playing Nick. It was just so clear that when he talked about how not knowing how many more opportunities were going to come his way, that he did not want this one to elude him. So he'll be very happy, even if he's not able to come to the Open, that he secured this prize. It was a must win for him. I think that's how he looked at it.
Yeah, totally. So looking at Rafa, I think looking at his performances throughout this whole week before the abdominal tear happened, I didn't think he was playing at his peak level, or, you know, like close to his very, it wasn't peak Rafa by any means, but it was still a pretty good level. Once he got through the first two matches, you know, I got the feeling he started working his way into the tournament, and the first two matches weren't really that surprising to me because he hadn't played on grass in 3 years. And
right.
You know, he struggled many times in the first week, a lot of times at Wimbledon. And so I wasn't too surprised by that, but I did start to, sort of see, like I noticed the the tape on his abdomen, I think in the fourth round against Botic. And then you could definitely see that there was something lingering there. And then in the Fritz match, clearly when he was serving, you know, at like 100 miles per hour and sometimes even less, you could clearly see he was diminished, and he was struggling a lot on his backhand as well. Like, not, you know, when he had to rotate and hit topspin backhands, he resorted mostly to the backhand slice, which is a great play against Taylor Fritz.
Yeah, but, it's a great play, but I thought that Fritz, if he'd been a bit more persistent in playing to the backhand slice, that he would have been better off than going to his forehand. But yeah, those two, not enough was made of your latter point. I talked about it a lot, but I didn't hear enough about it from others. Yes, we saw the restriction on the serve. We saw that he was having trouble breaking past, say, 102 miles an hour on the first serve for a long stretch. But having to go to that backhand slice as often as he did was not fun for him either. Listen, he won it on discipline, willpower, experience, inspiration, memory, all those qualities. It kicked in and it enabled him. And then, of course, he just got off to a big start in the final tiebreak at the end in the fifth set. You know, he just bowled it to a big lead and eventually won it comfortably. But I'd say that I'd agree with yours. He was not playing that well through most. Yes, Sonego he managed to beat in straight sets. He had a few moments along the way, but never felt like he was in total command. And part of it was the fact that he hadn't played on grass. Part of it is that it's not his best surface. And he hasn't been there since 2010, and he's grown immeasurably as a hard court player. But I would say on the grass, he's, you know, because he plays so little on it, it just hasn't been his favorite surface by any means. So we'll never know what might have happened had he been healthy and been able to play Nick and then potentially Djokovic. But I think there was always this sort of dicey aspect to it, Vansh, because of the procedure he did before the tournament that just would enable him to deal with that foot problem and get through it, and therefore also no matches leading up to it, just a couple of exhibition matches, but no tournaments.
Yep.
So asking a lot of himself on the heels of the French, where he'd had all the injections match after match, and I never really liked his chances, but I was impressed with how he made his way, you know, his professionalism in marching through the draw. And then once he left the court against Fritz, though, Vansh, I felt like I just couldn't see how he was going to go out and play Nick. I couldn't see how the news was going to be good enough that the tear was significant. And I think he, as he said later, he knew from the practice session that he wasn't going to be able to serve. He wouldn't have been able to serve any better than he did against Fritz. And that was not going to work against Kyrgios.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were points in that match where his coaching team, his dad and some other people in his box were notioning him to, you know, retire and just stop playing.
Yeah. And he wasn't defiantly telling them no, but I think it was his way of saying to them, look, I'm going to make this choice and I think I can get through this. And sad for the tournament that he, of course, was in no condition to play that. I mean, but that Fritz was so close, late in the fourth and fifth, that it would have been nice for Taylor if he could have pulled it off and then been out there playing a semifinal against Kyrgios that would have been, in my view, quite competitive, quite tight, could have gone down to the wire. We'll never know. But I think it's so rare that we don't, a Wimbledon semifinal is not played. So that was a dry day because Djokovic makes his comeback against Norrie and that was it. We didn't have a second act. And that was that was too bad for the fans.
Yeah, I have to say, it did surprise me that many people were, especially on Twitter, were, you know, suggesting that, you know, Taylor Fritz should be playing the semifinal and be given that second chance. And I just thought that's ridiculous. You know, why would he do that?
Ridiculous. No, you have to earn your way in. You can't then put him back in as a lucky loser. That's not how tennis works. But I also think it was unfair. Some people are speculating. There were a couple of instances, Vansh, back in the early 70s, and these are totally different times. Tom Gorman at the year-end Masters in 72 against Stan Smith, where he got to match point and his back was terrible, and he went up and shook hands and gave Stan the match. And almost identical the next year in Boston at the same tournament, which was moving around in those years, John Newcomb landed badly after hitting an overhead. And he pulled something, hurt something in his leg, and he knew he was in no condition to play the final. So he defaulted against Tom Aku, who played Nastasi in the final. So those were magnanimous acts, to be sure. But also in those days, Vansh, they didn't have these sophisticated trainers around and these kind of tests that Rafa could take to see how big the tear was. So I don't think it was fair that people kind of, some of them people on television, I think, were speculating, should he have defaulted near the end of the Fritz match? Not reasonable, not fair, because he doesn't know what news he's going to get the next day. All he can do is try to get through this match. And I'm sure he felt very badly for the tournament that he was not fit to perform. But that wasn't something he could know for sure until the next day. And then what happens? Suppose Kyrgios had gone out in practice and broken his leg. I mean, anything is possible. So I think Nadal was just trying to give himself some chance to stay alive. But people should not have expected him to just walk up to Taylor late in the fourth set and say, it's your match.
Yeah, for sure. Just one other question I kind of had, I wanted to ask you about, which is that, you know, we've seen now over several majors, Novak and Rafa, they just have something special when, even when they're not playing, when they're physically, when their bodies are failing them, and they just have so many tools and they've worked on it many years, and they're such great at adapting and adding new things to their game and just finding a way to tough it out and win. But at the same time, you know, you definitely see some criticism for these next gen younger players to be like, you know, this is their chance. Why are they not putting these guys away? This is the second time, for example, that Fritz was in a situation where he was playing an injured Djokovic or Nadal. Couldn't find a way to get over the line. So should we be critical of him, or should we be more complimentary of the all-time greats in Djokovic and Nadal?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So that's,
I think more the latter, Vansh, more the latter. I would be somewhat critical of Taylor, not so much for the one with Novak in Australia. Uh-huh. I think there's too much he could have done in the fifth. He got outplayed, but here he got so close in the fourth and fifth. So I would be a little critical of him, but he wasn't going to win in all candor. He wasn't going to win this tournament. He could have maybe made the final. I think the criticism is more probably, wouldn't you say, that the public is more critical of the likes of Zverev and Tsitsipas and those guys who haven't been able to make the breakthrough yet. Team was able to do it, winning that U.S. Open over Zverev, but the other guys not making their breakthroughs, that's not an invalid criticism, but I still say this is about enduring greatness and enduring consistency on the part of Djokovic and Nadal. This is really quite astounding.
Yeah,
because you don't normally have players. I mean, in the past, we saw Sampras, Becker, all those guys, Edberg. They around 30, they were it was sort of ingrained in them and expected that when the 30 was sort of the bell was ringing and you better get ready to leave. And that's just how it was back then. So the players would mainly retire in their early 30s or right around 30, Chang as well. And so the fact that these two guys are still so incredibly ambitious and they have their historical quest in terms of the Grand Slam titles that keeps them going. So that makes them even more motivated. But it's just a great tribute to two guys who are 35 and 36 that they're still as great as they are.
Yeah.
And that they're fending off the younger. But I still say the time will come for the likes of Zverev and Tsitsipas, and certainly for Carlos Alcaraz. We know where he's headed. I have no doubt when he starts picking up majors, he's going to get them in clusters in the years ahead. He's just growing into his talent. He's 19 now. He just needs a little more time. But I still think the other guys will make their mark too. But in the meantime, we should just appreciate the just astounding consistency and drive of these two great champions, Djokovic and Nadal. How do you feel about that, by the way?
Yeah, I've always, in these sort of debates, I've always leaned to the latter, like you were saying. And, you know, it's just so incredible how they keep on, and how they just keep on raising the bar, and just, you know, even in their mid-30s. And that's where I think actually Roger, you know, he sort of showed that, you know, you can play really well at 37, 38. And, you know, I still distinctly remember Novak sort of hinting at that in the post-match in their 2019 final after he just won, you know. And he really has a lot of faith in his body that he can play for another 4 or 5 years at least. So it's very it's very commendable actually what these guys are doing. And for Novak to have won 9 majors after the age of 30 and Nadal to have won 8, it's just crazy.
9 out of 21, that's almost half, not quite half, which is pretty remarkable. But you know what I noticed, Vange? Looking at Djokovic, I was sitting near the front of the press interview room a couple of times near the end, watching him walk in. And he's just so incredibly streamlined thin. And I think that's also going to be one of the secrets to him carrying on for those 4 or possibly 5 years, whatever he decides, that you just alluded to, is that he's decided in these latter stages of his career to be trimmer than ever. It doesn't seem to diminish his power, but I think it's one of the reasons why he feels he won't get injured. There's definitely a purpose to it, because he's fanatical about keeping himself that thin. And I think for him, that's one of the secrets. Obviously, Rafa's build is different. He doesn't have the same kind of a diet. He doesn't do it that way. But frankly, he is much more injury prone for the most part than Novak. Mm-hmm. Listen, if anybody had ever told Rafa at age 22, 23, you're going to be around at 36, you're going to win your 14th French Open, he would have laughed. He would not have believed it. Djokovic, I think, for a long time, hoped and believed and counted on being around now. But Rafa did not. And I think he's always going to be grateful, even if he never hit another ball, even if this foot injury did not resolve itself and he decided to retire later this year, which I think is highly unlikely. Mm-hmm. He would be exceedingly grateful for getting these years in his 30s and performing at these levels now, which earlier in his career he would have thought was just inconceivable.
Yeah, for sure. And I have to say, just stylistically, I really enjoyed watching Djokovic and Nadal much, much more into their latter stages of their career like they are right now than I did in the earlier part of their career, which is, you know, I guess many would disagree with me there, but I definitely...
No, I would totally agree.
I definitely think they're just better all-around, all-court players now.
They are. No, they are. They're more craftsmen. They've learned so much about the game on a tactical level, and they've skills. Djokovic's backhand slice, for instance, is far better than it was in his younger years. And, you know, he's much more confident about when to come in and how to execute up there. And Rafa's the same way. I mean, Rafa's so much more aggressive on the faster courts now than he was when he was younger. So it's really commendable to see what they've done to diversify their games and add these elements. And it does make them more interesting. That's exactly what I found myself thinking about Djokovic in this tournament, how much more enjoyable it is to watch him perform. And not that he wasn't electrifying when he was winning his first title at Wimbledon in 2011, but there's just something about how he plays now, the thought that goes into it, the craft, the versatility, and he's cerebral. He's really cerebral. And Rafa is in his way too, but I think Djokovic is particularly cerebral in his approach to match play. So they're they're a joy to watch. I feel like in Roger's case, it's a little different. He had this style from a young age. And yes, he improved his backhand, started especially from 17 on. It started with going to the bigger racket in 14. But from 17 on, we saw Roger coming over that backhand so much more confident. But that was more of a technical thing, and the other two, it's more tactical, I think. But it's great to see that kind of a change come, to see players in their 30s doing what all three of them have, but particularly in the recent years, what Novak and Rafa have done. Remarkable.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more. And, also Djokovic has become such a good spot server. It's basically Federer-esque at this point.
Yeah, very similar. Roger could probably go a little bigger at times, slightly bigger, but not a great deal. And yeah, I mean, when Novak is serving his best like that, he'll put it on a dime. And and that also helps as he's gliding through these service games that he can get some free points. Well, the one that I love the most, he serves extremely well down the tee in the ad court, when he's on, and he can go out wide over there. But the wide, and obviously down the tee in the deuce court, but the one that is devastating now is the slice serve wide in the deuce court, which you'll look at that clock and you'll see 102, 103, 101. It's the spin. It's the spin that's devilish. He gets around the outside of that ball, and it's just unstoppable because it's short and wide in the box. And it's just, again, it's fun to watch him hit that particular serve.
Yeah, totally agree. You didn't mention Carlos Alcaraz. So I think we should talk about him because, obviously he was close to losing in the first round itself. I mean, there were a lot of question marks about how he would play on grass, and it was quite fun to watch him play. Definitely, there were some doubts coming in. He hadn't played in Queens. He had a bit of a nagging elbow problem, and he was close to losing against Jan Lennard Struff in the first round. He was down 2-love in the fourth set tiebreak, and then he found something special and then won the fifth.
Great pass on the run when he was down 2-love in that breaker. And let's be fair to Carlos. Struff is that was one of the trickier draws you could get.
Yeah.
And then after that, Carlos played very well up to the Sinner match, and then he just got thoroughly outplayed. That was one of the best matches I've ever seen Sinner play.
Yeah, I would say that's the best match he's ever played in a major.
Yeah.
For sure. For me, it was for him not to get broken at all in that match.
Yeah,
save never all lost. Seven break points.
Yeah, and that's four sets. And devastating to have a couple of match points in the third set tiebreak and not seal them, not put it away there. And then come back and serve just as well in the fourth and get it done then against a kid this dangerous.
Yeah,
that was very well done on Sinner's part. And strangely enough, I'm not sure Djokovic wouldn't have had a slightly would it would have been fun to watch him play Alcaraz. And obviously Sinner took him back to five. But I think Carlos is just he needs a little more seasoning on the grass. I'm not worried about him. He needs a little more experience on it. But wait till he gets back on the hard courts over the summer. I mean, I still say he's going to be extremely dangerous at the U.S. Open.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I think he's one of the top contenders there. I think the only slight concern for me with Carlos is just he's played sort of two poor sets in each of the slams matches that he's lost. And then it's sort of been a little bit tougher for him to come back from there. The Berrettini one, the Zverev one, and then right. Now this. So I guess.
Yeah, true. It's
but,
true.
But he's very young. It's it'll come.
Listen, I could see him getting on a pretty good roll at the U.S. Open, though, too, and maybe avoiding those longer struggles. Who knows what the draw is like, but most likely Novak's not going to be there. And we'll see if Zverev is ready. But this could be a big opening for Alcaraz if he can take advantage of it.
Yeah, for sure. Then for Sinner to have never won a match on grass and then, 0-4, I guess, coming in and then to have had the run that he did here. I just love the way he's able to slide on it, his footwork, his balance. He's one of the better returners, and he's got a great running forehand as well. So I think one of the best in the game. So
it was great that day.
To like.
Yeah, it was terrific that day. And, his backhand is very solid too. So I know we know how great he is. That was a big step in the right direction. I think he also knows what we were saying earlier is true, that this was really more about Djokovic collecting himself and stringing together three magnificent sets in a row than it was anything about a Sinner collapse. It was really a Djokovic escalation in play.
Yeah, for sure. And then, of course, I think we should also mention some of the names that were missing in this tournament. I'm not talking about the Russian and Belarusian players, but you know, names like Marin Cilic, Matteo Berrettini, Bautista Agut as well, getting bouts of COVID. And then I felt like it was unfortunate for Berrettini, having won two titles on the grass and looking so good after hand surgery, to not playing this event is unfortunate, because I think he would have fared really well.
And almost equally bad luck for Cilic, coming off the French semi and knowing that he the finals here against Roger in 17. And that was very hard for him, I'm sure. Now, I was worried. And then you mentioned Bautista Agut, and he's a former semifinalist as well. I think it was worrisome at that stage when there was with those three big, pretty big names there. I thought, oh, my God, I hope we're not going to see this draw decimated. And fortunately, from that point on, things sort of calmed down a bit.
Right.
And we didn't get a massive withdrawals, but it was looking a bit. We all were a bit concerned when those withdrawals occurred.
Yeah, for sure. And then obviously you also had, Hurkacz getting a really tough draw in Andrei Davidovich-Fokita. That was a tipsy topsy match. And then obviously you had Felix Auger-Aliassime. I think he got one of the worst draws, in Maxime Cressy. You could possibly have.
He did. Yeah. Now Cressy is a nightmare to play, and Felix, of course, had done so well there a year ago to beat Zarev, and I think it was too bad that he couldn't get out of the Cressy match. He might have gone a long way, but there wasn't much he could do on that particular day to stop Cressy.
Yeah, for sure. Another American that did really well at this tournament is he's not talked about as much as Sebastian Korda and Jensen Brooksby, but I've seen his. I've actually had the pleasure of knowing him personally, because he went to the same tennis academy as I did when we were both younger, and from San Diego he is. And he's, I've watched his rise very carefully, and he's done really well on all surfaces now, and he's improved on the clay, and he's become I like the way he's headed, and he's cool, calm, and collected, and that's Brandon Nakashima. And he got all the way to the fourth round. He beat Denis Shapovalov in the second round, and pushed Kyrgios to five sets. So I think he can do some damage in the hard court swing.
I felt sorry for him. He's a very understated guy, nice guy. I've had a couple of interviews with him myself, and he's very likable, very congenial. And that was unfortunate for him, because Nick was having an issue with his shoulder that day, and through much of that match, serving in the 130s, 20s like we normally see from him. So there was an opportunity there for Nakashima, but Nick, of course, was singularly focused this tournament, and he pulled it out. But I did like the way Nakashima played in this tournament. I hope it's going to carry over into the summer on the hard courts, where he could do a lot of damage from now right through the U.S. Open.
Yeah, totally. It's going to be interesting to see how all the Americans do, because obviously Korda wasn't able to play here as well, and he's
right.
He would have liked his chances as well to go make a deep run. But
yeah, I'm worried about Korda. These little things, these little absences. I mean, niggling injuries. They're not necessarily serious injuries, but we haven't seen him be able to avoid it for long periods over these last 2 years, at a time when he might have grown more as a player. And there's plenty of time, but he seems to me to be hurt a bit more than any of those other younger generation Americans. So I think they need to, that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I agree. And then obviously, the not having Russian and Belarusian players is quite unfortunate. And, there was a lot of talk about that before the tournament began, and including, even a month or two ago. But I guess for me, what's more, when I look at this tournament and I look at the rankings now on Monday, I think it's just a total injustice to me, just because now the rankings are totally irreflective of what we're seeing in terms of form, and it just doesn't sit right with me. I just feel like, why did the ATP and the WTA sort of, hurt their players in this way? There was really no need for it. I see their need to sort of prove to Wimbledon and the rest of the slams and, show that, you can't just take a decision sort of unilaterally. I guess they were pressured a bit by the British government, but I don't see really how this helps the situation one bit. And on top of that, they didn't even freeze the points from last year. So it's like none of them ever played the event to begin with. So it's just...
No, it was a horrendous decision. Gaudenzi on the men's side with the ATP, and as a former player. Steve Simon, an enormously popular individual running the WTA, took that brave and impressive stance on Peng Shuai. I mean, wait a minute, what did I say? Her name is always tricky, but you know what? This decision made no sense whatsoever because of what you just said. I mean, you're harming your own constituency. And the lunacy of Djokovic going down from 3-7 and losing 2,000 points. Why? So the idea was to strike back at Wimbledon. Yeah. Well, first of all, I disagree with that posture to begin with, because Wimbledon had a tough decision to make. And I know the two associations claiming this is against their rules, that the players should have been allowed in based on the rules. But this was a unique world situation in world history, a unique moment in world history. And I think Wimbledon had to weigh a lot of things. But in the end, they made a choice that I found myself agreeing with. Some agree with it, but you certainly could see the complexity of the decision. So I think it would have been enough, Vaunch, for the WTA and the ATP to just make a statement saying, we vehemently disagree with this. We want to go on record. This is wrong. Our players, all of these players should have been allowed in, but they could have just left it at that. But by then saying we're taking the points away, Wimbledon didn't suffer for that. Nobody, that's not going to matter historically to Wimbledon. It didn't matter as the tournament unfolded. It matters to those players that they lose out on those points. And in the end, I just find it inexplicable. And I did at the time. And sure, you want to take a stance, but this was not the right stance to take, in my view. And I think they may come to regret it. And it skewed the rankings, too. That's the problem. We've been able to look at them until now as a pretty accurate reflection of where these players belong and on the worldwide scales. But this just messes up everything. And not just for Djokovic, but for others. And players couldn't defend points. They couldn't earn new points. It's just, it's going to make those rankings open to question in a way that they didn't have to be.
Yeah, totally agree. I guess we should just look at the race and just I try to just look at the race and just see sort of like, you know, kind of add the points, like had they been awarded. But it's just, even that is just, it's just not accurate anymore. So I guess it was unfortunate, but not much you can really do there.
No, not much you can do, but I wish they would have I wish they would have waited or just reconsidered at the time and said, you know, this is not, this doesn't make sense to punish our own players, because that's again what it was, and it's a shame.
Yeah, I guess what it did reaffirm again is just how special Wimbledon is, because you know, most of all the players were there, the ones that, you know, pretty much you know, apart from I guess Naomi Osaka, who mentioned before that the points was sort of a factor, and she did have an injury as well. So I guess, you know, that was also, that was
initially
also part of it. But
yeah, initially she mentioned the points, then it was the injury. That was very disappointing to me when she did that as a four-time major champion, to not understand that was not, you don't want to do that to the sports centerpiece event. Start saying, as she did initially, well, if there are not any points, I'm not sure I want to play. That didn't look good. I don't think she thought it through, frankly, at the time. It was something, was sort of a quick gut reaction, and one that I would suspect she regretted later on.
Yeah, I agree. And it just reaffirmed again how special Wimbledon is, and you know, the prize money and the prestige sort of trumps the no ranking points. So I guess that was one thing I took away from this. But I guess let's switch gears a bit and talk about the women's side a bit. Obviously, you know, coming in, it was Iga Świątek and her winning streak, and but it was clear throughout the first three rounds, especially first couple of rounds, that you know, Iga Świątek was probably not going to win Wimbledon, just the way things were going, and it was just going to be extremely tough for her to adapt this quick on the grass, and it was a bit too much to ask, right?
Yeah, it was, and so I felt sorry for her, the dominant force, winning streak, sweep right through the French, seemingly poised and ready to maybe do it here. But then when she lost, I thought, okay, Ons Jabeur is such a great opportunity for her. And she goes to the final, and I thought she was going to win that final, frankly, the way she started the first. So what were your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought so as well. I thought with her ability to keep Rybakina guessing, and her drop shots, and her the way she can change pace and sneaky good spot server. And I just thought them, I was looking at the matchup and I just felt like this was going to be a good one. But at the same time, I did sort of see that there was going to be some potential for a let up from her, or maybe some poor decision-making like we saw in the beginning of the second set. And then Rybakina just really found her groove from the back of the court and just served tremendously. And she moves very well for her height at 6 feet. And, you know, we've known about her for a while, but she really sort of really put it together and just was too good in the end. So
she was, no, she was overpowering. The first serve is terrific. And she gets it. She moves forward well.
Yeah.
And most of the other women players who are great side to side, she really moved forward extremely well.
I was impressed with how she adapted mid-match, because in the first set, you know, it was bringing her up to the net was a good tactic. But then afterwards, yeah, she really got down lower and started committing to it and, you know, hit some really good volleys. And especially the way she got out of that 3-2 love 40 game in the third set.
Well, that was the match
right there.
It was reflective of An's just, you know, she had 11 break points and only converted 2. And those were both in the first set. She never broke her again. And An's really suffered from the inability to convert more of those break points. And it was interesting because Jabeur was so exuberant in the first set. There was a lot of sort of fist pumping and excitement and a sense that she thought she could win it. And by breaking again at the end of the first set, she had a chance to start serving in the second. It was all going her way. But in the end, she was definitely outplayed those last two sets. I think as a personality and she could become such an incredibly important force in women's tennis and may yet. But I thought it was going to start here. I thought this was going to be where she secured her first major. It was not to be. And not entirely her fault either.
Yeah, for sure. I just love the way she carries herself. I love how much she takes that responsibility of playing for her nation and, you know, doing it for Arab women and Muslim women and first African. And it's just, it's so great. And she deserves to be number two in the world because she's shown remarkable consistency all the way from Charleston to basically here. And the first round loss at the French Open was tough, but I love the way how she bounced back from it. And I get the feeling that she's going to win one major. I really do.
Well, I think so. I think so. I just thought, you know, she'd sort of set it up beautifully that the way she played that first set. But hopefully there's something she learned. So I don't think she's going to be moping around for weeks on end after this. It was still an important step in her evolution to in that Wimbledon final. And we'll see a lot of great tennis ahead from her.
For sure. I have to say I was expecting Simona Halep to do better. I was, she did very well to get to the semis and she had some good form coming in, but I was not impressed with her in that semifinal. 9 double faults and, 38% points won on second serve. And it just wasn't a great day for her. What did you think? Well,
when you serve 9 doubles, your percentage, you're going to have a hard time having a better percentage of second serve points won because that's a lot of lose. But yes, I was disappointed by that too. I think she felt the pressure of, she was getting pressured so much on that second serve that that may have caused some of those doubles, the sense that she better get it in with depth. But you're right. It was, she played better against Anna Samova. That was a nice performance. And she wasn't able to sustain form in the semis. And I did think heading into the semis, she might win tournament. So from that standpoint, I'm in agreement with you that it ended up being a slightly disappointing performance.
Yeah, totally. And then obviously you had some good stories with Tatiana Maria and Maria Buskova and Maria Sakkari. I guess that was probably maybe a match she would want back in the third round. And same with Ostapenko in the fourth round as well. But I guess it was also great to see the Williams sisters back in action. I was hoping, hopefully, I just hope they play a little bit more before the US Open and not just go in completely cold in Serena's case, because I did feel like had she gone through Harmony 10, she could have gone on a nice run in her section of the draw.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. I just find it hard to understand, though, that if you're going to go over to Eastbourne, you haven't played for a year. You just play the doubles in Eastbourne? It just didn't make any sense to me. She could have potentially gotten a few matches in there that might have made the difference at Wimbledon to getting her much deeper into the draw. And then her press conference afterwards, Vonch, was she was a little ambivalent. You didn't sense that she was like now going to go all out for the U.S. Open. She sounded a little certain about her plans.
Yeah.
And at this stage, she's got to have there needs to be a plan, because, you know, you're not going to play till 45. So, you know, this next year is pretty crucial for her. And she showed some pretty impressive form in that loss at times, and even had, I think, a four love. She saved a match point, and after she'd served for the match, then she saves a match point. Then she's four love up in the tiebreak at the end, but couldn't close it out. And I'm hoping that we see a couple of hard court tournaments and then the U.S. Open, that she gets serious enough to do that much, so that she could come to the Open with at least some chance of getting into the latter stages. Because if she just pops into the U.S. Open as her first appearance since Wimbledon, I don't think it augurs well for her.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And she showed some good things in that match. Physically, I thought she held up pretty well over 3 hours. And, and you got the feeling that if she had played maybe a slightly more orthodox opponent, I guess, you know, and a more of a power player, let's say, you know, it might have worked out well for her. But I agree, she needs the reps and she needs some more match play coming in, because it's unreasonable to expect to just, you know, show up and go really far. So,
yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, no, overall, I thought across the board, it was a great fortnight and some memorable matches in there. And, you know, it'll go down in the history books, definitely, as a Wimbledon to remember, despite all the storylines coming in.
Yeah, and you had this, that's true. And you had the same inimitable Wimbledon scenes at the end where the champions go out with their trophy and the crowds are down below cheering them on vociferously and warmly. And the pageantry of Wimbledon is really still something to behold. And I don't think people are going to look back on this tournament any differently. There'll be no asterisks, and they'll look at this one the same way they do every other Wimbledon, that this is the preeminent event in tennis without question.
Yeah, it really has a special aura to it, and you can see it in the players and in the way the tournament, the 100 year anniversary of the center court was great as well.
By the way, it was a really, we should touch just briefly at the end here. That was a nice ceremony. It was terrific that Federer flew in. That added a lot of luster to it. And he was interviewed, and that you had, so many great champions there. Marta Navratilova had COVID, so could not walk out on the court, which was a shame, but you still had Chris Evert, and you still had so many great players appearing there. And, you know, there were some that were missing, no doubt about it. And Serena was apparently still in England and didn't attend. And Sampras, Agassi, Connors, the great Americans were not there. So it was unfortunate that Moore did not return, but those that did made it into the monumental occasion it was. And the ceremony was staged as elegantly and meticulously as you would expect. That's just the way Wimbledon runs things. So it was really nice. And Sue Barker and McEnroe out there, and McEnroe got to get his own applause amidst announcing everybody else. But he actually did a very nice job of announcing the others. Great enthusiasm and energy. And so I enjoyed that ceremony very much. That was actually on the day that I arrived, on that middle Sunday.
Yeah, for sure. It made it really special. And let's hope Roger can play one more, like he said in the interview. It's going to be tough, but
And also, should add that, you know, not only having Roger, but to have Novak and Rafa participate as well was very nice. And there's an amusing moment where we don't know what was really said, but you see the picture later on where Novak was whispering something to Roger. Roger was breaking into a grin. That was nice to see too, because they're such fierce competitors, but here was a lighter moment and they were enjoying it.
Yeah, for sure. It was great to see that. And Steve, this has been awesome. I love this time of the year, because it means we can do two recaps within 1 month. So it's great. And I look forward to the US Open and to our chats afterwards.
So do I, Vance. You take care of yourself, and we'll speak again after the Open. Looking forward to that very much.
Yep. Stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll chat later. Thanks. Thanks so much for your time.
Okay. Thanks for having me, Vance.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.